Tonight, though, we have Tim from Pressboard. I've been working with Tim for the last few months. Tim's been really big, working with startups for years now. He's, I think he stumbled onto something pretty awesome here, and he's been using all the scary stuff in Azure that you can think of.
So, yeah.
So I'll just get off the stage and let you jump in, but thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Pressboard. Pressboard is the name of the company. And before I tell you more about Pressboard, I'll tell you a little bit about me. I'm an ad tech enthusiast, is what I call myself. This is my third ad tech startup. My first one was when I was 15, back in 97. I taught myself how to program PHP and MySQL. And this was back in the days of GeoCities. And I had some friends, they created some websites, and they wanted to monetize it. One of the joke site. And you'd go to this joke site, and what you'd see is 10 banner ads, one joke, 10 banner ads, one joke. And I thought, that's really good.
That was you, huh?
I was the one who fixed that problem. and I thought, this is ridiculous. So what I built was essentially a tool that let those web developers scroll the banner ads in the system and rotate on the website. So you'd only see the one, and it would optimize for the audience. Now, ironic, it feels like a lifetime ago, because now we're on Azure, on cloud, and infrastructure as a service, it feels so accessible to everyone. But at the time, I had to rent some hosting space, a little bit of space on a server, shared space from a hosting company. And I quickly outgrew my quota, so I would get these angry calls from the hosting company saying, we're either going to kick you out, or you have to pay us, $2,000 to $3,000 a month for your own server. And for a 15-year-old guy who doesn't make money off this, it didn't really make any sense. It's hard to justify. So I sold the company, and I sold it to when I was making a fortune off of them. And the last one was where I made my business partner. We started that one in 2010, sold in 2013. That was the price of the market. And the thing that really brings it all together for me when it comes to ad tech is this idea that, there's a lot of money to be made in ad tech. There's a lot of companies who spend a lot of money in advertising. And it sucks. Nobody likes advertising, right? So as soon as you do some innovation and you create a better user experience for the end consumer, you're delivering value on both ends of that spectrum, there's a lot of money to be made. And then other than that, I code, I'm an architect, product manager, because in everything that I've done all my career, being very close to the user, understanding the problem, making sure that what I'm building isn't being built in a vacuum has always been a big mantra of mine. And I enjoy the experience of entrepreneurship. And my business partner, who I started Pressboard with, he used to work at Newad. Now, I don't know if you guys know much about Newad, but I'm sure you've seen the billboards in the bathrooms of restaurants and bars and some schools. They're an advertising company. He wrote this when he quit his job to start this business with me. And he went viral on LinkedIn. It just goes to show you the power of stories. He had a problem. He was CMS from my last company. That's how I met him. And at Newad, they had a challenge. They had 10 blogs that they were trying to monetize, and they were doing it through display advertising, just like everyone basically online is doing today. And it wasn't paying the bills. There was sort of this time when social media and mobile was starting to really take off, and it was changing the way that people were consuming content. On a smaller screen, you can't display as much banner ads. People find their stories on social media, so they don't go to your website anymore, where these publishers used to monetize or make the most amount of money because they just did it with banner ads. And so he was tasked with trying to figure out an alternative way to make money off these blogs. A challenge is facing pretty much the entire industry today. And sure enough, he started talking to his brands that he used to work with, and every single one of them unanimously said, why don't you get your editorial team to write a story for us, and we'll sponsor it, and we'll pay you a lot more for that. Sure enough, he did it, it worked, he got paid a lot more for it, but it was a lot of work. 240 man hours to get a single story out. There's a lot of back and forth that had to happen between him and the brand and the publisher, and the analytics were just a nightmare. Well, there was definitely an opportunity there because not only the publishers need to make money, they're looking for new revenue. The brands are looking for better ways of marketing. And if there was a way to sort of automate this process and make it more efficient, then there's an opportunity to make more money. And that's when he approached me. So we sold the company last month in 2013, when he started Pressboard at the beginning of 2014. And the idea there was to create a marketplace, a platform where brands can just come in, all the publishers are already plugged in, you can RFP these publishers, they'll write the stories for you, they'll publish the stories for you, and we'll track how well they do, and you transact based on that metric. And then this is what the stories look like that we produce. We work with a wide range of publishers, everyone from your traditional print publishers who are now trying to migrate online, to your digital-born publishers like Advanced and others of the world. And the way it works, and we work with a lot of brands as well. We work with TELUS, CPA, Best Buy, we have PayPal, Nintendo, Honda. And these are some of the results from the stories that these publishers have done for our brands. They basically write the story, the brand approves it, we post it on their website, and it's presented by Best Buy, TELUS, Kudo, CPA. And they love it. And we got doing it for it. So, since we launched basically in 2014, we partnered with over 100 publishers, where we have created over 700 custom branded stories, and these have been read by over a million people. And we analyze stories to try and understand what people read, why they read it, what constitutes a good story. We try to use that metric when we make a sale for the brand. And these are some of the publishers that we're working with. And really, the idea here is, this is traditionally how publishers make money. You buy your brand, you want to advertise your company, you buy some banner ad, it goes around the story. And it's a big market. But it's having challenges. We have ad blockers, sort of blocking ads, something like 40% of people are not blocking ads, so publishers are hurting for revenue, their brand's message is not getting out there. And so what we're saying is, why don't you just sponsor the story? The story itself becomes that. And that's a $4 billion bit of marketing in 2015, and it's the fastest growing, actually, segment of digital marketing today. Grew 34% in 2015, estimated to be $135 billion market globally. And it's because content marketing works. The first thing that comes to my mind when I think content marketing is PR. I don't know how many of you have done it, but a lot of companies do this, where they contract a PR agent for upwards of $10,000 a month for a 3 to 4 month engagement. And at the end of the day, the PR agent comes back with a handful of stories. Maybe you got into the Wall Street Journal, but likely you got into a handful of publications nobody's ever heard of. And you take that and you show it to your boss, or you sort of show it to your customers, 5 minutes, game over. Sounds like a ripoff to me. And that was really some of the challenges that we were trying to address as we were getting into content marketing. And this is where the whole idea of data and algorithms are turning marketing into science comes from. It's not, it sounds ridiculous to me that in this day and age, when you have access to all this data, you're paying $40,000, $50,000 for some stories to a PR guy, and at the end of the day, all you have to show for is a story, where I would wager the person that reads that story about you has shown enough intent in your business, in whatever it is that you're selling, service, educating or entertainment, that you should have access to that person. You should be able to reach that person after they read your story. You should be able to follow up, you should be able to retarget, That person who read your story is probably just as valuable, if not more, as somebody who comes to your website. And we have these tools right now where you can retarget somebody that comes to your website. But the way it works today, you pay a ton of money, you get a bunch of traffic to your website, and you've seen this. I don't know how familiar you are with retargeting, but you know, you go to BestBuy.com or Walmart.com or Microsoft.com and everywhere else on the internet that you go, you see their ads. And it's effective, it's powerful, it works. It works, and there is no reason why your PR shouldn't work the same way. For somebody who reads your story, you should be able to follow around the internet just the same way. And we wanted to bring a lot of that into what we were doing. And there's a lot of challenges when it comes to doing content marketing online. And the three areas that we identified as something that we add value for our customers was search, creation, and measurement. Search because the publishing landscape has changed. You know, there is no longer your big conglomerates of the world like your Wall Street Journals and the Forbes that control the channel and they're the only way that you can do PR. Now you have easily accessible digital publishing tools that anybody can use. Anybody can be a publisher. And I'm talking about all the way from your Wall Street Journal of the world down to your mom and pop shop bloggers who are talking about some niche ideas or just expressing themselves people follow them. And they even have a name for themselves. They call themselves influencers because they are. So there's millions of these guys. So how do you know who to work with? On the creation side, you've got all these publishers that you want to work with. Like I said, when I met Jared, when he was doing this on his own without a platform, it would take 240 hours to get one of these campaigns off the ground. Nobody in the marketing wants to wait that long. So a lot of challenges to be solved there. And the measurement part, which is really the data heavy part, and that's really where Azure came to help us. What it was the third area that we help out. It all sounds maybe easy, but it really wasn't. So just to let you know, our dev team right now is just two people. It was me for the first 18 to 20 months, and then I was fortunate enough to find somebody that's now helping me out for the past several months. And we're 2 years old. 2 years old, but we managed to do over a million sales in our second year. Last year, we just closed the year up. The reason is because we were able to develop a lot of these technologies quickly enough, get into market fast enough, that we could actually get to the value proposition that we're promising our customers. And that's not an easy feat, especially when we're talking about lots of data, when we're talking about cutting-edge technologies that are just coming out, cloud computing, Azure, you name it, and with a small team of one. So, but we did it. We did it, and we did it because we were really able to solve these problems. Finding the right publishers to work with, knowing who the right guys are that you should be working with, influencing your audience, niche ones, and mainstream. Yeah.
I was just wondering, do you guys broker the people that broker between the people that write the content and the employee that want to display the content, or do you write the content and you give the content to the displayers, or what do you?
The publishers, they write the story.
Okay.
Yeah. So the idea here is, let's say that you want to get a story published on Nancy Buzz.
Yeah.
Nancy Buzz, they know their audience, right? So they've been writing content for these guys. They have a certain voice that they write in, and they obviously have a successful business out of it. So you don't really want to stray too far from that. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But what we have done that's really set us apart is we've introduced this new metric where the brand only pays when somebody reads a story. So even if you get a story published on Nancy Buzz, but nobody reads it, you don't pay. Which is a huge risk on everybody's part, but the brand's love it, obviously, right? That wouldn't be possible without data and some of the challenges that I'm about to talk about. But that has to introduce accountability into the equation. So whereas you might see a lot of advertorials created online right now, they call it advertising, sponsored content, and all it really is a glorified piece about how awesome the brand is. We strictly discourage that. And the reason that we discourage that is because no one's going to get paid if the publisher writes that story. Nobody really wants to read about how great, you know, my company is because I'm awesome, right? They want to know what I'm going to do for them, right? So we say this to the brand, we say this to the publisher, we say, listen, write a story, good story, people are going to read. And because they need to get the reads on, they actually put their entire social weight behind it. So they push it on Facebook, they push it on social media, where a lot of traffic is coming from. And that's really how we ensure that we've got good quality content, we're only paying if somebody reads it. And so far, we've actually been able to generate more revenue from these publishers than the ways they traditionally generate revenue. Sorry, did I answer your question? Okay. Yeah, so actually the idea is the publisher needs to write the story, right? So the brand just comes on and says, listen. So for example, for Best Buy, we did a story where it's like the top 10 apps that you should download in the future, right? That's an interesting topic that people need to read. And it's also in Best Buy's best interest to align themselves with that because they're in the business of selling phones, mobile, etc. Good question there, because this leads me into this topic of the measurement. And this was the one area that's really lacking online in digital marketing today. Most people transact on cost per click, cost per thousand impressions, and nobody, and it doesn't really translate well to content, right? You want people to read your content. Actually, a lot of companies right now do write a story for you, but they would charge you based on how many people saw the headline, not even the content itself. Again, doesn't really make a lot of sense. And these are really some of the headwinds that we have to overcome if we want to make this a scalable business. And to do that, this is, we needed to really dig deep. We wanted to figure out who's reading a story, how many reads the story gets. How much time are they spending with the story now? If you're paying $10,000 for a story, you know, I think you at least deserve to know if somebody spending enough time with that to make it worth your while, at least next time you make it visit. Where that traffic is coming from, are they sharing your story online? Do they like it? What is that engagement like? The location where people are reading your content, that makes a huge difference. And you want to dig even deeper than that. We want to see, did somebody read your entire story? Did they read half of your story? Did they scroll all the way to the bottom? Did they not scroll all the way to the bottom? And stories are fundamentally different to some of the other forms of advertising online, like display, where somebody would see a banner ad, click on it, go to your website, you measure that. But content is fundamentally different. It's more of an influencer piece. It's more of a branding piece. It's more designed to entertain, educate, inform. So people don't necessarily click through to your website after they read that story, but that's not to say that that story isn't more powerful than that same banner ad. And one of the ways that we measure that is through views groups. So if you have a story that's out there and somebody reads it, if they end up on your website and make a purchase in 2 weeks, there's probably a link there. And we want to be able to measure that. So 2014, April, Jared says, this is a problem, there's a lot of money on the table, let's do this. I said, sure, no problem. In my previous company, I worked with Azure, I liked Azure. I knew right away that we would have unpredictable ways of growing, and we had some unforeseen challenges that we'd be having with trying to scale this business, trying to really dig in and get to some of the data that we're interested in. And there's just no other alternative. So Azure right away, and I built a... By the way, how many here are technical and have worked with Azure? Okay, perfect. So you guys are familiar with the terminology, the cloud services, web rules, whistleblowers. And it was a very, very basic architecture to begin with. We decided to rely on Google Analytics data because a lot of our publishers already had Google Analytics on their website. They use it to measure the performance of their websites themselves. and they have API, so we thought, why not? And the way that we designed the MVP was basically out of worker role. This was hosting our .NET Web APIs. We have an Angular UI, an AngularJS front end that's a single page app. And on the back, we had two SQL databases. One was just the application data, and the other one was the analytics data that was pulling from Google. And the way that we pulled that data from Google was we had a service bus queue set up, so on a daily basis, Azure Scheduler would basically queue up a message through our worker role to our web role to the worker role that would pick up that message, call out to Google's APIs, pull all the data in, put it into do some processing, put it into a SQL database, and that would be accessible to the front end. Except that we quickly outgrew that. Not only we started to sign on more publishers because they really like this idea that you can make money off content, not just display it. Ad blockers don't block content. But we also started to attract some of the really large publications. I mean, we're in talks right now with the Wall Street Journal, with Forbes. We already do some work with Fast Company. We work with National. We work with all the top Canadian publishers. And I don't know what your experience has been, but I'll tell you, I'm not really a DBA. I chase opportunities and I figure out how to make it work. And it is so hard to get a lot of data into SQL Server at once, especially when you're on a time constraint. I wanted this data that came in on a daily basis to be available to our sales team both on the East Coast of Toronto and in Vancouver in the morning when they got to the office. They're 3 hours ahead of us, so they usually get into the office at 7 or 8 in the morning. That makes it 3 or 4 in the morning for us, or 4 or 5 in the morning for us. And I wanted, some of our sales team, again, they work late into the night, they need to be reporting, they need to get back to the clients. Our clients, they might be working through the night. So I identified this window of time from 12 until 4 in the morning that I wanted to pull this data and get it ingested to SQL Server. So it was ready in the morning and then they got the office and they just do their work. And about beginning of 2015, we got to the size where we were processing about 2 million rules of this data coming in. And I just really couldn't get into SQL Server that easy. So I had to figure out a way around that. And that's after a lot of research, I decided the way that we were going to do this was by partitioning SQL Server. And we were going to have a bunch of staging tables. And we would load this data in parallel. So I had a whole bunch of worker roles, and they would scale up automatically when the process started at midnight. We had a queue that basically queued up for every publisher. We spun up a worker role. We went to Google, got that data, processed that data. Each worker role would ingest that data into one staging table, and then we would swap that partition into the main query table using bulk copy. And that was fast. Again, I don't know how familiar you are with SQL Server and how to scale it, but hands down, the fastest way to get data into SQL Server is using partition. Because when you get data into one table and you're trying to get it into the other one, if you're doing a partition swap, it's only a metadata change. So the data on the server is actually not moving. Whereas if you're trying to get data into a table, you have to turn off the indexing on, and you have to, it takes a lot of time to get this data in. And I also had to deal with edge cases, like what happens if the expands. If some of my pipeline just breaks down, and I have to go back and I have to ingest the data from yesterday or the day before. What if it's just one publisher? What if I had to redo an entire day? How would I do that? And that's when I realized you can't delete rows in a big table at anything. It just doesn't work that well with SQL Server. It takes a long time because it logs every single week. Again, another problem that partitioning of the salt. So this worked. This worked great. It was fast. We managed to sort of get over this stage of our growth. But I wrote a lot of code to make this, you know, upwards of 1,000 lines of code just to make this piece work. And we're, you know, 12 months into this business and we're still the only one developing. So I can't be sitting there and managing this pipeline while I'm also trying to push the business forward, talking to the customers. We have to iterate on the solution. And as it turns out, Google Analytics is just not sufficient on its own either. And there's three reasons why we couldn't just rely on Google Analytics. One is there's no easy way to figure out how many unique people read a story. Now I can send a request out to Google's APIs and I can say, tell me the number of unique users in the past 24 hours, and it'll give me that. But that doesn't necessarily guarantee that person didn't also come and read that story yesterday or 2 days ago. So now I'm counting multiple times. And because this data ties so heavily into our business model, when we're actually charging the client based on the reads that we're promising them, that's not going to cut it. I can't, in good conscience, go to my customer and say, listen, I think 400 people read this, but it could have actually been closer to 350, but I still want you to pay me the extra. Tracking was the other problem. So, you know, sure enough, we figure out a way to mitigate that problem. But there was no way for me to actually tag these people that came and read these stories because I had no presence on that publisher's site. It was only Google Analytics. It was only what I could get out of Google that you know, I could transact on. Which limited me heavily with some of the goals that I had. You know, wanting to retarget these people, wanting to do view-throughs, other metrics that interest me. Didn't do that. But probably, hands down, the biggest flaw, and this is not just Google Analytics, but this is the majority of analytics platforms on the market today, calculate time spent on page like this, where you land, you click through the story, you land on page one of a website, and they log this as a page view. And then you click through to the second page on the same domain, they log this. And afterwards, they measure the time difference between the first page view and the second page view, and that's how they determine your time spent on a page. Now, you know, again, traditionally, this was statistically encompass a large enough number of your viewers that it would still be accurate enough as far as if you wanted to know how much time someone's spending your stuff. Well, this is really critical to us because I don't want to just count a page you have read. It completely defies the whole purpose of what I'm doing, which is selling reads. I need to be able to accurately say that this guy spent 3 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute on this page. You know, was it a bot? How do I know if this was just a bot or this was a real person? And probably the one thing that has broken this model more than anything else today is that nobody browses websites anymore. People find content on social media and primarily on Facebook. So what happens is you find a story on Facebook, you go read it, you go back to Facebook. And then you do some stuff on Facebook, you find a story, you go read it, and every single one of those transactions is recorded as zero time spent on page. Because Google just can't figure out, no one's doing it. There's ways to do it, no one's doing it. And that just didn't work for us. So we put the code on site, and now not only we can track uniqueness, because we can cookie that user, or if it's on mobile, or if it's somewhere else, we can unique identifiers of the device. But we can also figure out how much time they spend, because for the duration of time that they're active on a page, we send an event back to the server once a second using JavaScript. And we measure activity on that page based on those events, as opposed to logging view per view per view. So once a second, for every visit, we would report back. Unless you were inactive. So if you switch tabs in the browser, or you just left your browser open and you walked away and decided to do something else and you came back, and even though the browser was open, we still can't really count that as engagement. It's not actively engaging with the story. And so for that, what we did was we started to track mouse movements. We started to track scroll behavior. So we would send back mouse position and scroll position with every single one of those events we send back to the server once a second for as long as you're active. And you know you're not active if there is no activity happening on the page. And for those period of time, we don't send an event back. So if you're inactive after 20 seconds, I don't send back an event to the server. If you come back and you start being active again, I'll continue where I left off. So now I'm only measuring your activity on the page. I'm not measuring your inactive time. Which is great. It really works in principle, but then it creates a big data problem. So we built the front end, and on the back, we had the code on site. We did that only using JavaScript. And just this month, we got to 50 gigabytes of data per month that we're collecting. This is up from 30 just 2 months ago. And this really just speaks to the volume of data that we have to collect in order to really be able to report on some of these metrics that I talked about. Right now, we're ingesting about 33 events per second through the system. But we're not doing attention minutes on every story that we have put on site. We're doing it only on the branded content that we're selling to our brands. And the reason we're not doing that yet is because we didn't really have a data pipeline that could process all this data. This 2000 is page view. So every time our code gets loaded, I still track that page view, but I'm only doing attention minutes on a story for my branded content, which is a very limited subset of the stories that I have access to. And for everything that I want to be able to do with my brands and with my publishers, like tell them, what are some of your most popular stories? What are people reading? How much actual time are they spending into your stories? Should you write a story like this again? Does this story have the potential to reach the audience that you want to reach? Is it going to be as influential as you want it to be? And this isn't just for branded content. Our publishers care about this. They have expressed to us, we want to see this for all of our stories, because this really opens up a new world for us to be able to run our business drastically different to how we are today, because they're relying on new analytics. They're getting the same crappy metrics as I was. But if I was to do that today, with the publishers that I'm working with today, code that I have on site today, I would have to be ingesting 1,000 events a second. That's my potential today. And this is growing. Like by the end of 2016, I'm expecting this to be at 2,000 to 3,000. So we're growing rapidly. We've got all this data we're ingesting. So I had to figure out a way to do this on Azure. And this is still work in progress, but it's coming along nicely. And I'll just share some of it with you. Yeah. So this was the piece that I had in place already this month. With my Google Analytics APIs, as a worker role, I was pulling in the data and I was dumping it into storage. And then I had to add everything else to it from there. So we have our client JavaScript that's sending all this data back to a Node.js backend. And the Node.js backend, as well as pulling all the assets to the server and the sponsorship into the story, is queuing all those events up to three event hubs. And that's because there's really three tracks of data that's coming in. There is our page views that we're tracking, there is our attention limits that we're tracking, and then there's the inquiries that we're tracking as well for that. And once that data gets collected inside of event hubs, you have to pull out of event hubs, do something with it. and I decided to use string analytics. You know, I could have written some worker roles that would tap into these event hubs, pull the data, do something with it right there. I chose to go with string analytics for two reasons. One, because I didn't want to write code. And I'll speak more to that in a second, but when you're talking about a startup with one or two developers, and you're trying to move your business forward, and you're trying to build a sophisticated data pipeline and improve your architecture, and you know, I also have to worry about, as the business grows, I have to worry about hiring, I have to worry about a number of administrative things that take a lot of time away. I don't want to have to sit there and manage code. The less code that I can write, the more efficiently my business will run. Because what I can outsource to a platform as a service is literally taken care of for me by somebody else. And that's no different to stream analytics. And the other reason I wanted to go with stream analytics was because, like it's saying, it implies stream analytics, I can actually run SQL code on my data in lifetime as it's coming in. If I need to do some aggregates, if I need to do some quick calculations, things that I want to be able to report back in real time on, I have that opportunity. So it gives me a extensibility point, to say the least. Now, I haven't done that yet, and to be perfectly honest with you, there are some technical issues around some of these services because they are so new. One of the challenges that I ran into with stream analytics and trying to do streaming aggregates on it was that the data coming into the event hubs weren't always structured enough. There was enough anomalies in that data that this service would fail. And there isn't really with stream analytics. There is, if you're using Spark on a Hadoop cluster, you have more options available to you. But with stream analytics, there isn't really an option to say, you know, just ignore the certain portion of data that might not be formatted properly. And there is no option for you to have a user function in there so that you can cleanse this data that's coming in. So for now, I'm just using it to basically pull this data and to store it in Azure storage as JSON files. And it's going to be sitting there right next to my JSON files that I'm pulling in from Google Analytics. And you know, just next month we're also releasing an integration with Facebook, and that's going to be right compatible running with this. So then there will be a whole set of other data coming in from Facebook. There's no shortage of data that I have to deal with. Once all the data is in storage, then I have options. Initially, I decided to try out Data Lake and Data Lake Analytics. It's a new product that just came out on Azure. It's based on Apache Yarn, and it uses this scripting language called USDL that Microsoft designed, and it's basically combining SQL with C#. So you can write these hybrid sort of batch applications that then they would manage the processing of, the running of, on any number of virtual machines scaling up and down in real time in the background without you having to worry about it. So you know, just imagine if you have to set up a Hadoop cluster and your data was coming in, and you know, you have to write a Hive script to go and process this data. You have usually a pre-allocated amount of nodes listening in your cluster. If you're trying to get something closer to real-time processing in your data, that architecture doesn't really work very well because it takes 20 minutes just to get a Hadoop cluster running and then 20 minutes to scale up.
Yeah.
But this,
so the data's going into the storage there. How,
yes.
Are you partitioning it somehow so that you know which files you have to process?
Yes. So the nice thing with Stream Analytics is it actually lets you break the data up by date and hour. So these are all sitting in separate folders, each separated by date and hour. So once an hour, it gets its own folder and gets in there. And obviously three separate locations on storage. Now with blob storage, you don't really need partitioning necessarily, right? As long as you've got the right folder structure set up. But definitely partitioning becomes more of a factor within these services. Now, the other thing that I wanted to do, I mean, this is nice. So all these services are available to me. So basically here, at my USGL scripts, they would pull the data from Azure Storage, you know, and some additional data sets that I have, like MaxMind, where I take the IP addresses and I convert them into a location so I know where this feed is coming from. I combine this, I process this, and then I dump it back onto Azure Storage as CSV files. And one cool new feature of SQL Data Warehouse on Azure and SQL Data Warehouse in 2016 coming out is Polybase. Have you guys heard of or worked with it at all? Or yeah, Jeff, I did that. So the cool thing with it is now inside a SQL Server, you can actually create an external table on your CSV files, and you can run SQL queries on it, just like you would be on Hadoop with Hive. You create an external table on your CSV files and you run some queries on it. Now you can do that inside a SQL Server. Which is great, because it, in some extent, makes it a lot easier to ingest. The problem I was having earlier with trying to get a lot of data into SQL Server at once, well, this really mitigates that, where now it's taking on the responsibility of, I'll just go and I'll see all these files, give you the location of it, and I'll take that data, and then I can just write a stored procedure that pulls all that data, creates it as a table inside of SQL Server, and my ingestion problem is taken care of. There were some challenges here. One was, this is really, to be honest with you, not yet ready for prime time. The CSV files that it creates for some reason has some access issues on it, so that Polybase and Warehouse couldn't actually read it. And I'm using Data Factory as my pipeline. So you know, I needed to be able to start my script and stop it on Data Factory, and it was having a problem sending me the parameter. And so we're just trying to figure that out. But in the meantime, I came out with another solution that worked pretty well. And so as nice as this is, you still need a way to manage it, this pipeline. Like, this is not, you know, like I wrote over 1,000 lines of code just to deal with this, you know? I couldn't even imagine what it would take to try to wire this all up using worker roles and C# on the server. Just the number of places where problems can occur. Basically, everywhere there is an arrow and everywhere there's a service, there's a chance of failure. And when things can fail, things will fail. I mean, with my miniature sort of data infrastructure that I have in place right now for my Google data, this happens to me, you know, several times a month, where I get a call from the sales team and data didn't show up today. And it's almost always a different problem, whether it's an authentication problem on Google's end or it's malformed JSON files coming in that I hadn't accounted for. And you can't, if you're going to build this, if you're going to code around this, you have to take all those edge cases into consideration. Your pipeline can't just fail. Maybe a slice of it will fail, and you need to be notified of that. You need to know where that failure occurred. You need access to the detailed logs to be able to understand what the problem was, go fix the problem, and you need to be able to redeploy this problem right away. You can't have it being tied into other pieces of your software. You can hold that. And that's where Data Factory really comes in. And for that, I'll just actually show you. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to just go with Data Factory. In fact, in theory, it meets all of my requirements, but you know, I didn't really quite know. And actually, interestingly, when I did that, when I moved my portion of code that I had written to manage my Google Analytics data onto Data Factory, this is all the code that I ended up removing from my application. Like a significant amount of code that I removed from my application, which I cannot say enough. Being a single developer of a startup trying to push your business forward, there is the less code that you have to manage, the more time that you have to build and move the business forward. And I love getting rid of code. It's my favorite thing. So I did. I got rid of all of this, which is incredible. And I actually have a much more reliable infrastructure that is capable of scaling far and away to what I had before, as well as enabling me to tie in with all the new data sources that I'm having and collecting today and will be tomorrow. And I don't have to manage it as a single line of code. To me, that's significant. And this is what it's and this is what it ended up looking like. And this is cool. Again, I don't know how many here have played with Data Factory before, but it's basically a time series pipeline. So you define your slices in terms of time, whether it's an hourly basis or daily basis, and you'll have your data sources. So I have data in Azure Blob Storage, I have data in Azure Table Storage, I have data in Azure SQL Data Warehouse, I have data in SQL Server, I have data in Data Lake Store. So there's a wide variety of data sources that you ultimately end up using. And this, you know, getting it on here and managing it is as easy as a JSON script file. So, you know, for example, for me to define my SQL data warehouse, that's it. Put the connection string in there, name it. And now Data Factory can run stored procedures on there for me. That stored procedure has the power of scaling up and down my compute resources on the data warehouse. It has the possibility of reading external CSV files using Polybase and pulling that into the data warehouse if necessary to do some processing on it. And that literally took me 5 minutes, and I would probably have to code for a week to get the same sort of flexibility with it outside of the warehouse. Same thing with Data Lake or with my HD Insight. So I also have some custom activities. So one good thing that's great about Data Factory is you have these things called activities. And your activities are basically your units of compute that are doing something to process your data. So for example, in this case, I log the files that I pull from Google. I have an activity here that takes that JSON file and transforms it to a CSV file. But the data that I'm getting back from Google, it has a really ridiculously weird structure to it. It's JSON, but it's not a flat file. It's not just the rows of data that I'm getting back. It's got all these different levels to it. And the more that I'm working with data, whether it's data that's coming from Google, whether it's coming from my JSON files that I've created using Stream Analytics, or whether it's coming from Facebook or Twitter tomorrow, they all are going to look different. And they will all have unpredictable structure to them. And it's really hard to manage that if you're having to, again, code around it. And there is really no out-of-the-box solution to take a JSON file that's spit out from Google Analytics APIs and just be able to work with it. So the nice thing with Data Factory is it has a lot of built-in activities that you can use. So if it's anything on Azure, if it's data that is familiar to it, so it has activities for stored procedures. Yeah, that's really easy to write and figure. It has activities for running Hive scripts, Data Lake scripts, for running, just transforming blob. But it didn't have anything for Google. But the good thing is, you can actually write custom activities. So just a little bit of code, and you upload it to Azure Storage, and Data Factory can pick up and execute it in your pipeline. And that's what I did here for transforming my JSON files to CSV, so that further down the road, when I have my import store procedures and whatnot, that it's actually in a format that's understandable and coherent, and I can actually do something with it.
So are you saying that Data Factory only works in CSV formats rather than, say, raw JSON?
No, it can work with anything so long as it has a corresponding activity that can understand it, right? So there is, because the JSON files coming back from Google Analytics APIs are so stream-oriented, they are structured how Google likes it, right? And that's not really a standard by any means. So there is no way for any data factory activities to know what that structure looks like ahead of time to be able to work on it, right?
So could you take that Google JSON,
sure,
normalize it to KDE JSON, and it would work just as well as the CSV file?
Yeah, as long as you transform it to something, right? Like, as long as you transform it to something that you can work with, that's fine. And in my case, I decided that CSV was the easiest way to go. And the reason I picked CSV was because pretty much all these other services on Azure know how to read and process CSV files. So then that opened the door for me to whether I wanted to work with it inside of SQL Data Warehouse or whether I wanted to work with it using Data Lake Analytics. I had that option now. I didn't have to come up with custom readers and outputters for that.
Excuse me, just a dumb question. Would NoSQL be better suited for the data that you get from Google Analytics?
So no. So the data, because in nature this data is analytics, right? So you want to be able to run queries against it, right? You want to aggregate sums on this data. Traditionally, I actually use DocumentDB. DocumentDB is an NoSQL database on Azure for our application. We have a lot of data stored in there that's perfectly suited for it. For example, a lot of the messaging communication that happens through our system is stored in DocumentDB. Some of the data that we scrape from our publisher's websites that's residing in DocumentDB.
So I just jump in here. So when I stumbled upon what he was doing, the way I look at it is definitely like the writes to disk and all those initial writes have to be unstructured, right? So they have to exist in an unstructured other blob, document, DB, whatever the choice is. But then to get the analytics over time, you probably want to make sure they're in some sort of cohesion there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can like sum, average, whatever those like mathematics are.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what he's been building
yeah.
with the various tools, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so there is a chance. So what you could do, the end product of this pipeline could be data that you store in DocumentDB. If you have no need to go back and run any sort of aggregates on that data, so if you process it fully down to exactly the format that you know you'll be using on your front end, then yeah, for sure, store it in NoSQL. Just know that once you store that in NoSQL, if you ever really need to do a sum of, thousand different rows, you're pulling that in memory and you're running over it in that. So
yeah, you couldn't delay in the framework to exactly. Infrastructure to do some
yeah.
work.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Just going to say, one of the reasons you went with the data factory was the ability to get rid of some of your code. But you also mentioned that you needed to have visibility when things fail.
Yes.
Does this provide the metadata management that gave you the data lineage?
100%. I'll get that in a second. So you see these green signs means that my pipeline is functional correctly. If there is any sort of failure at any point in time, I get this little red exclamation mark, and that tells me that that's where I need to dig deeper because there's a problem there. And I'll dig into that in a sec. And so another thing that I should mention now, with Data Factory, that's great, it literally works in timeline. So if my something breaks down here, it stops running everything that comes after. So you don't have to worry about data correction. But yeah.
So on each of those steps, is it timestamping? Like, for example, when it goes to the blob storage there,
yeah.
I see a pretty box here, but obviously behind the scenes,
yes.
Let's do it in something like, because blob storage is just a blob.
Oh, absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
So how is that? Does it place some sort of unique identifiers on it automatically, or have you defined that? Or is it
yeah. So, for example, here, so these are my time slices. So I can actually dig into each one of these, whether it's my data set or my activity. I can dig in, and I can see what happened at each step. If one is pending execution or one needs to happen. And so you can dig in further there, but also the way that you define your data sets is is like this. So you tell it, you say, if it's storage, if it's block storage, and you give it the connection string for Azure storage. If it's SQL data warehouse, you give the connection string for that and whatnot. So in this case, this is my Azure SQL Server, and this is a table. So actually, my table is defined dynamically using my slice start date.
So it's automatically generating a table in SQL Server.
No, the table exists. This is basically like a mask on top of it. So this is it uses this data for two things. One, to get access to that storage, so it needs to pull data. And it's really just passing that from activity to activity. Data Factory itself isn't doing anything. It's just basically like a production line, right? So it says, hey, activity A, do this on slice one beta A, and tell me when you're done. When you're done, then I'll move it forward. Now, activity B, do this on this data set. Combine them, process them, change them. When you're done, tell me, and I'll move them.
So in this scenario, when you've got this table that's started with the slice start as the time, has that come from something external to Data Factory, or was that actually produced inside of Data Factory as part of the pipeline?
So Data Factory gives me the time slice that I'm working with, and I pass that into whatever, whether it's the stored procedure that I'm using or whether it's high activity that I'm running, and then I let that activity do what it needs to do with that time slice. So in the case of my SQL table, what passing that slice does is it just tells my stored procedure to create a table on and append that date to it. So now that becomes my time slice table. So, yeah, and just as a point of reference, the custom activities that you write, so for example, the one that I wrote here to transform my JSON to CSS file, that's actually running on an HTML site, Hadoop cluster. So you can, Data Factory can either automatically set that up for you, and then it'll send your C# code to run on there and do the processing that it needs to, or you could pre-allocate a cluster to it.
So if I recall correctly, I think Hadoop is pretty pricey as far as how much you need.
Yes.
So is it just spinning it up and tearing it down?
Yes, exactly. So you have the option. You have the option of saying, whenever you reach this point in the pipeline and you need to run this custom code, spin up an HTML side cluster and run it on there. You can also use Azure Batch. So if you want to set up a batch, you can have it on VM. Or you can actually, if you have an HTML side cluster that's running some data more permanently for you, you just add it to Data Factory as a link service, and you say, run it on that cluster, and that cluster is always up and it's all done. Right, so then it turns it into a CSV file. And once it turns that into a CSV file, then it basically goes into this part of the pipeline. And this one has two activities in it. And this is in my SQL data warehouse. So in my SQL data warehouse, I have a copy activity here. So there's two things that are happening in this part of the pipeline. One is there's a stored procedure in SQL data warehouse that's creating my time slice table. So it takes the date that's been passed there, it creates a table. And then the second thing that happens, once my CSV file is generated, then it's now being bulk copied into the table that was created up here, and now it's in the SQL data warehouse.
And that was the same one we saw in the JSON file that was referencing for all the other steps. Is that right?
Remind me which one?
Well, you just showed a JSON file that showed
funny
little syntax, some time slice.
Right. Yes.
Is that basically where that comes from? That table comes from this?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So that is the data set that's referenced by Zachary. So that's the absolute, they're really, and you see, and this is actually a bit of a hack because I need to create my table in SQL Data Warehouse before I import it into it. And I didn't have a way to sequence me running those two activities, so I had to duplicate my data set, but it worked. It works. And so you know, I create my time slice, I pour my data into that table, and I call another store precision in my data warehouse that's basically doing some processing. In this case, it's just rolling out the data into another table. And once that process is complete, this data set now becomes available. So now that data has been rolled up into this new table, and once this gets to go ahead, it now has two sets of activities that can start to work on that data. So I'll tell you two things here. One, I couldn't use Polybase. I didn't want to use Polybase as the data warehouse to pull my CSVs in. So I went with Ballpark. Why did I do that? One, because as your amount of CSV files start to grow in storage, every time the Polybase wants to read data off your CSV files, it has to do a seek, and it does it across the entirety of the data set. So it gradually becomes slower and slower until it will inevitably throw an exception. And so it's extremely slow in that sense. And the second reason that I didn't want to do it was because even at its best, it's still slower than if you're just bulk copying the data. And so for this copy activity, Data Factory actually uses a bulk copy to send thousands of lines and rows of data to SQL data warehouse at the same time. And it ends up being a lot faster. But I have to go a step further. I can't use my data warehouse as the analytics backend for my front end. And the reason that I can't do that is because there are, even though they're both SQL Server, they're still different beasts, to say the least. Data warehouse is really designed to cut hours or days even off the time that it takes you to process data. You have a really large data set. It has the ability to process that data in parallel. And, you know, the more compute resources you give it, the more of this data that it can process in short order. But it's not designed to cut milliseconds off your queries. And it has a hard 32 concurrent queries that could be running on it at the same time. And that really limits it in terms of wanting to use a free front end. So if you're using free front end, not only are you going to get much less performance out of it, but you will have this limited ability to scale your front end. You don't really want to have multiple data warehouse instances running. But that's exactly where SQL Server comes in. So SQL Server is the perfect front for SQL Data Warehouse, because you do all of your processing in SQL Data Warehouse, and once it's ready, once you're down to that last piece of data, if you choose not to store it in a NoSQL data store, which you can at that point. So at this point, I have the option of saying, you know, for this, my final layer, let's use DocumentDB, and my front end will use that. But I still wanted to provide some ad hoc querying capabilities to my end users. So I decided to go with SQL Server. And for this piece, I still use my partitioning and staging scheme that I came up with originally to ingest my Google Analytics data. So that's still in place. That's now really just this. This is the equivalent of what I had. Everything else is new. And that's not even considering my attention limits that are now also coming in the process.
So. Tim, are you using SQL Server, IaaS, or the SQL database PaaS?
Azure SQL. Oh, sorry, is that what called?
The PaaS.
Yeah, so yeah. Not SQL Server, SQL database, right? Has offered.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I try to stick to using as much of the cloud native products on Azure as possible. I don't really want to have to deal with infrastructure. I don't want to have to deal with managing VMs. I don't want to have to deal with
management. But to extend on that question, so have you had challenges with the DTU limits that Microsoft's put on? Are you using premium tiers? Or?
Yes, premium tiers for sure. Premium tiers for sure. It was a much bigger challenge before this data pipeline, because I had to do a lot of that processing right there inside a SQL Server. And SQL Server, again, like it's great for that last final step where you have some app queries you want to run from the front end. But if you have large amounts of data you want to process, it's really not designed to do that. And that's and it fits in perfectly with this model. So you know, I do all the processing and ingesting everything, and then I can actually load data into SQL Warehouse, or sorry, SQL Server using my staging tables and partitioning really, really fast. And just manages all of that for me. And once that data is sitting in there, I have my columns for indexes, which are basically the new in-memory columnar indexes that were used in SQL Server 2014 and even 16. So it makes it extremely fast. And I can get, I mean, so far I'm on a P1 and that more than meets my requirements as far as that. And that's my pipeline for that. And then there is, so I model my attention minutes exactly the same after I figured this out. So same thing happens. In the case of my attention minutes, they're coming in through event hops. They're Stream Analytics is dumping into Azure storage as JSON files. The reason that I didn't, you have the ability to output data from Stream Analytics as CSV files. But if you're not confident in your structure, again, that problem that I was having with trying to run SQL online stream data that's coming in, then you're going to get malformatted CSV files that are almost going to help you. So I just went with JSON. And then again, I have my custom activity that transforms that to a CSV. And again, I just added to my data warehouse. And so I'll show you this, what an error looks like in here. So if at any point in time, something fails, I get this little fail slice in here, and it tells me. So actually two nice things about this, the way the data factory works. One is you can set retries. So if something fails, and again it does, things fail, it'll try as many times as you want it to try. You know? So if it was just a temporary issue that might have resolved itself, you never have to worry about it. Again, you can set up alerts on it so it can alert you if something goes wrong in your pipeline so you would know, so it has all that built into it. But ultimately, if it does its retries and fails, it alerts you, you come back and this is what you see. And it gives you details as to how many times you tried to execute your activity, and you can really dig into this, and you can get even down to the actual exception that was thrown in that service that failed while trying to process your data. And this really, really helps with trying to debug where something went wrong in your pipeline. And I can't emphasize this enough. When you're the only developer in a company and you're managing everything, and this is just one aspect of everything you have to manage, having the ability to dig in there and know exactly what went wrong, when, where, and you're notified as it happens, and to go back and be able to debug and fix it as soon as possible, is an enormous advantage you get in the cloud with Data Factory that I wouldn't have otherwise.
So a time slice here represents a block of data, I want to say.
Exactly.
So in this scenario where it says it's failed, have you currently lost that window of data?
No. So where it failed, was here. So you can see the prior steps are still green. So my data came in, it was formatted into CSV files, this is sitting in an Azure blob storage, and then I tried to run this activity, and something went wrong.
So the data's good up to that point.
Yeah.
Is there a recovery mechanism in this part?
Well, so my data is still here. My data is still here, and now I can, let's say I see this exception, like, oh, I know what it is, I'm gonna go fix it, so I go fix it, and when I'm done fixing it, I come back, and I just right-click on this, and I say run. And it reruns that activity for you. And if you've solved the problem that you were having with it, there's nothing lost. And as soon as that finishes processing and it's ready, it'll move on to the next idea, activity, and so on and so forth. But if it runs the same problem again, it'll still stall there. So the guarantee that you're getting is your data is still available to you, but it's basically just sitting in that dormant sort of state until you go fix the problem.
So it looks like in the scenario you have there that one of the data items was corrupted or wasn't something to read and come in. Is this still flowing for new data slices that are coming through?
Absolutely.
It's just a block in time that's...
Yeah. It's just that one slice of data that had the problem.
So things are...
Exactly. And it's really important to take that into consideration when you're designing your data pipeline, that ability to repeatability. It's really important, and they give you a lot of tools in order to be able to do that, but it's important to keep that in mind when you're architecting your pipeline, because you don't want to get into a situation where if one of your time slices fails, that it'll corrupt all of your data and there's no way to recover. But you do want to be able to come back here and just say, rerun. And then rerun UGL from the course. As long as you think that it's going to design your data architecture with it in mind, then yeah, it's just as easy as, let the follow-up slices keep going forward. I've got that little problem, I can come back and address it when I have time. And I guess we're going to spend on application with cool. So here's the really the next nice thing that comes from all of this, and this is just the beginning of the story, really, for us, right? Now we're finally at a place where, with one developer, we've been able to set up this sophisticated data pipeline, and we're able to pull this data in, ingest the process set. It ties heavily into our business model, so we can actually transact on that business model, we can run our business, and if your business model is your unique competitive advantage, like it is for us, where you only pay us when somebody reads the story, this is now enabling us to really deliver on that and grow the business. But once you have the data, once you can process it, that's when doors just begin to open. There are a lot of things that we can do with this data that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise if there was no way for us to process it. A lot of people think machine learning is hard because you have to know statistics and you have to know algorithms. But I don't get me wrong, it's hard. But if I didn't have this pipeline and I went out there and I hired a data scientist and I said, hey, listen, I'm trying to figure out, when person A reads this story, are they going to read also this story? If I didn't have this pipeline in place, if I didn't have a proper data architecture in place that would allow him to be able to run those algorithms on the data, it would be completely useless. And now we're positioned so that tomorrow, say I hire a data scientist and I say I have all this data available to me, can you help me draw some insights from it, which I know I can, and my publishers want me to, my brands want me to, then the next step that I can just plug into that data factory pipeline is Azure Machine Learning. And I can get my algorithms in there, I can get the data flowing in there, and in data factory it's as easy as saying new activity, machine learning, and the data will begin to flow in there and do your thing, and you output that again into a data warehouse, you can work with anything else with it, otherwise you keep flowing into your SQL Server, and now it's available at your front end. And for a two-year-old startup to be able to say, listen, I'm ready at a point where not only I'm collecting enough data, but I'm also managing and processing this data efficiently enough that I can get a data scientist to start to deliver this for me, I think is something that would have been unheard of if we didn't have access to Azure and the cloud and the flexibility that comes with a lot of these platform-oriented services where you don't actually have to manage infrastructure. The infrastructure becomes an extension of yourself. And that's really what I have prepared for today. So,
awesome.
Thanks a lot.